Welcome to Louisiana Lefty, a podcast about politics and community in Louisiana, where we make the case that the health of the state requires a strong progressive movement fueled by the critical work of organizing on the ground. Our goal is to democratize information, demystify party politics, and empower you to join the mission, because victory for Louisiana requires you. I'm your host, Linda Woolard. On this episode, I finally have a conversation with Chris Pouchot, who I've been trying to schedule for almost 2 years. Chris and I worked together on the Unanimous Juries campaign in 2018 and have stayed in each other's orbits ever since. I've almost gone a whole season now without doing an episode on Unanimous Juries, so I thought it was time for me to rectify that. Chris and I get into every aspect of what made that campaign so successful and further illustrate why I believe it's the campaign model, Democratic candidates and progressive issues, not to mention party building efforts, should be following in Louisiana. What comes up again and again is the need to relationship build and coalition build well in advance of election years. We talk about several of the groups that we worked with on Unanimous Juries, but we could have mentioned many more, like Vela, who worked in Vietnamese and Spanish speaking spaces for us. Like the Indivisible groups that harnessed some of the resistance midterms energy, and like Step Up Louisiana that we focused on so thoroughly in season 3 of the podcast. While we're releasing this episode on a day when the nation is heading to the polls in one of the biggest elections of our lifetimes, we aren't focusing on that because we're trying to create evergreen content as a roadmap to long-term growth. The big takeaway, once again, is that the work towards future victory is a year-round, multi-year effort. There are no shortcuts. There is no magic. But if you're doing it right, within that work, you'll find camaraderie, joy, and glimmers of progress. Chris Pouchot, welcome to Louisiana Lefty.
Hi.
I've been trying to get you on the podcast for almost 2 years, I think. And
yep.
I have yet to discuss the Unanimous Jury Coalition this year, so I thought this was a timely moment to bring you on.
I selfishly, in the most conceited of ways, feel like I'm your white whale of a guest. I like to think of that, right? Like you're like the last one that you haven't gotten, you know.
I love it. Well,
who is your dream guest? If you don't mind me asking you the question.
I don't mind you asking the question.
Has it been asked before?
No, and I actually don't know the answer.
Who's your top, like, is it like Carville? Is it John Bell? Is it like?
I would love to get John Bell on. I don't anticipate doing that while he's in office. So, I just assume him not be in office.
That's a good one. I would like to see you talk to James Carville. I know he's not like the most like progressive guy these days, but like.
That's okay. I'd love to talk to him. I don't know that he'd be willing.
Y'all would have a good convo, you know?
I would love that. I'm sure there are other people I've thought of that are not coming to mind right now, but
yeah,
if I think of them, I'll let you know. But I always start with how I met my guest. So I want to get to that. I think we met on the Unanimous Jury campaign. Had we met prior to 2018? I don't remember it.
No, not that I can think of.
No, yeah, I think we met. It might have been by Zoom the very first time.
I remember calling you and you were doing something with your parents and you couldn't make a decision yet. It looked like it was a good yes, but like you needed to work some stuff out. And I was like, fine. Like, I am okay with that.
Before Unanimous Jury Coalition, before everything else, what's your political origin story? What first got you interested in politics?
Oh my God. Politics. I mean, I guess my family, I'm from Baton Rouge. My family had always sort of been politically adjacent. My dad was the first Black student body president at LSU. And I think that's opened some doors. Like he was on Dutch Morial's campaign staff when he won the mayoral election. And then he worked in Congress back in the 70s. So, yeah, I mean, like, it always had been out there. Like, he'd always just been a part of these, like, sort of coalitions and organizations, and his good friend, you know, we grew up with Jay Darden and his family. We were really close back in the day, and I, you know, still keep up with his kids. I guess it's always just been there, right? You know, the first campaign I remember was the Cleo Fields race back in the 90s. My uncle went to law school with Cleo Fields. They were really good friends. And I remember Cleo had gotten this bus, and he had gotten like Steve Urkel, Jaleel White, to play basketball with him. It was like Steve Urkel and like Doug Williams, the NFL quarterback. And we were at the Sports Academy. I will never forget this. It was the wildest, like, bunch of people watching Cleo play basketball with Urkel. It was hilarious. But like, I guess like my real start with really getting into politics, I did volunteer when I was younger on the Don Cashew congressional race. For any politicos, is like sort of the snowballing effect of what we have in Louisiana. You know, when you think about it, 2007.
Are there any other political career highlights that led you to UJC?
I did some work with Together Louisiana. This was probably 2015, that we were trying to stop St. George. And it was actually not technically Together Louisiana. It was like this other group that was born out of Together Baton Rouge.
Okay.
And like this group that was trying to work to incorporate a section of unincorporated Baton Rouge, create their own city, which would have been pretty bad for Baton Rouge. They signed up a bunch of people, and we thought like, this looks a little weird. And so we went door to door to the people who signed up and asked them if like they wanted their names off the list. And a lot of people had no idea that they signed up for things.
Oh, wow.
It was quite the challenge. We ended up stopping it, but they had 2 years later when they were able to restart it again, they did it. And now I think there's a bunch of like legal fighting right now over, but like they got it voted in, and then, but it's all tied up in court still.
So. Gotcha. Okay.
That was like, I guess, my first like real, like I'm grinding in this.
Well, anyone who has listened to Louisiana Lefty should know by now that I hold up the Unanimous Jury Coalition and the Unanimous Jury Campaign as a model for what could and should be accomplished by our side, the progressive side in this state. We've talked to so many of the players, from Ashley Shelton to JP Morrell to Mercedes Montagnus to Norris Henderson. Sum it up, this was a huge criminal justice reform coalition push to pass a constitutional amendment to end the discriminatory practice of non-unanimous juries in Louisiana, which, like many other people, I did not know we had that practice. And once I heard about it, I realized that was completely unconstitutional. How could we possibly be doing that here? But you and I worked on that campaign, and I want to get into it. I know you brought me onto the campaign to run the statewide field efforts. I believe your title was deputy director. Is that right?
Yeah. It was, I guess, deputy director. I mean, it was pretty.
You were running. You were generally running the day to day of the campaign. How did you end up involved in that?
So I was at OPD, the Public Defender's Office in New Orleans. And because of my work with Together Baton Rouge, I had really taken an interest in like a lot of the legislative advocacy that OPD was participating in. And they had been part of a group called like Louisiana for Prison and Alternatives. Mm-hmm. It was headed up by a guy by the name of John Burkhart, whose office was like around like next to my office at OPD. He took that and went to SPLC, Southern Poverty Law Center. And John had been working on a lot of like the Justice Reinvestment Task Force and the package, the Justice Reinvestment Package. He'd done that, I guess, in 2015, 2016, a lot of those like bills that had come out in 2016, 2017 got passed. In 2018, some of them got rolled back. But one of the things that did go through was obviously constitutional amendment that he pushed. And so I was looking to leave the state because my partner was moving to New York for law school, and I was like gonna go with her. And before, as I was like, I'm gonna need to start like looking for a job soon, I got recruited to help run the campaign from a couple of folks. It was from there where it's like started from nothing, you know. I guess I started July 1 of 2018. I was the first employee, and we worked out at the Justice Center. It was pretty fun.
Well, the coalition itself was a critical piece. How long had members of that group, I guess Power Coalition was already in coalition with a lot of those folks, but them aside, were the other groups connected at all prior to that?
So the UAMIS Jury Coalition was actually like a lot of these folks, like Power Coalition and Palm's Justice Initiative, Vote, SPLC, ACLU, Louisiana. I'm trying to think. I know I'm missing a few Innocence mm-hmm. Projects. A lot of these folks have had a presence in the legislature. So, and a lot of them were part of the Louisiana Prison Alternatives.
Okay.
So it was sort of just like a specific to the campaign coalition that was created. So everybody had been working together. The first like initial meetings had already been, you know, when I got on, it was like SPLC and PJI and Vote. And we were just like thinking about like who else to bring in. And so there was like a big meeting with everybody. And so we didn't even have a name, right? It actually happened at the first.
Okay. Like,
what are we going to call ourselves?
But eventually there were, I don't know if this is from the get-go or if this happened mm-hmm. over time, but you were bringing in DAs and folks who would normally be considered conservative on the spectrum, political spectrum. How important for this issue was it that the coalition had both conservative and progressive voices?
You know, that's a interesting topic. So there were DAs that were involved in the legislative like outreach of this. And so I didn't have any part, like we had already had those guys like part of it. So like sort of that initial meeting that we had, which was like, I don't even remember. I can't tell you how many people were on it. There was just like, there was a lot of people fitted into a room and a lot of folks on the call. We had some buy-in, and then we had some work to do to get like larger buy-in for like the more conservative folks on the group. And so, yeah, like there were some conservatives from other parts of the state that were already on board. And so we worked with them to sort of get others sort of who had voted to put this on the ballot. So, you know, they weren't necessarily against it getting out. We just had to sort of nudge a little, you know, into helping us.
Well, we had a robust communication strategy for mm-hmm. unanimous jury campaign. It included strict message discipline, as I recall. We were on top of that constantly across all parts of the campaign. And that was largely driven by polls you had done before I even came on. And I will say I studied those intensely. The first thing I did was just dive into the polls. Talk to me about those polls. Like, how did you go about getting them? And then how you integrated that information into the campaign?
Yeah. So the polls are pretty confusing. There is a poll that we had done that somebody had like given in kind as an in-kind donation. And so that one, I think, was probably the one that you got. There was another one that came out probably around the time you were starting. Those polls were really important for us to just see where we are see where we were, like in judging how we were going to how are we going to like move navigate the state, right? You know, some places like Lafayette had certain, you know, certain feedback that led us to sort of change how we initially thought we were gonna like work in that area. Other places like Baton Rouge had showed like a ton of potential that we had not really thought about, you know, where we thought this was going to be very New Orleans centric. And we knew like we were going to have some, we knew we were going to have to go to Baton Rouge, but I didn't think we knew how the potential of Baton Rouge. Like, I think we definitely underplayed it. Once that poll came out, it's like, oh, we need, you know, we have a lot of potential to do some, to get a lot of votes out here. And then like Shreveport had some interesting polling numbers, and so we had a presence out there. And then obviously like the northeast portion of the state was sort of, you know, had some hurdles that we need to get through, so we did have a bigger presence. But you know, I feel like we probably could have done more out there.
You're mentioning the regional stuff, and we did have a different strategy for each region, different methods of reaching voters in each region. Some of it was just earned media or paid media. Some of it was, well, what I really liked is that you tailored who your messengers were even for each region, like who you sent to specific regions mattered on what that polling showed, like what the significance there, what really spoke to people. Was it faith-based? Was it, you know, like what really who your best messenger was you were sending there. The message didn't itself change. They were all variations on the same idea. It was just tailoring it for the area. I thought that was really important. I think it was really important also the surrogates you chose specifically for some of the earned media, the interview pieces, were folks who were impacted, directly impacted from the non-unanimous jury practices.
Yeah. That was definitely work, getting the right messengers, you know, a little mix of like who's willing to do it and who do we feel like, you know, would be a good messenger for this particular region or this particular group. It was really important for us to get people who have been impacted by this. It was not easy at all to do that, mainly just because there weren't, like for me, I was not privy to a ton of people who had been directly impacted by a non-unanimous jury, right? And then there was some folks who said they had been, you know, convicted with a non-unanimous jury and who were out, but like, you know, you need to have access to like the records to make sure like if you go on do a commercial or you do, you know, piece of earned media with somebody, like you have to make sure like this person was in on a like was convicted of a non-unanimous jury. So finding those folks was not the easiest like thing in the world. The guy that we landed on that we got was Glenn Davis, who it's a wonderful guy, but I think was something where I had used sort of my experience at OPD, where like I was trying to be very protective of him, because I think he did get like sort of pulled in a lot of directions, and we just wanted to make sure we wanted to be respectful of him and his time, and like, you know, be very careful to like not like traumatize him, or like for him to like share the things that he wants to share. And that was a very like touchier subject than I think people would probably initially think of, but we spent a lot of time on that, to be honest. And it was very key to us, like to our messaging, to have somebody like Glenn.
Well, back to the polling also drove who we targeted in our field efforts, because we could see who would be moved by what. But I think also a major thing that played in the field efforts was just knowing that we had to educate a whole lot of people who we knew were going to turn out to vote. People, chronic voters who we knew were going to be in the
chronic voters
voting booth. We wanted to make sure they understood what it meant to vote for this amendment. So that was a big part of the targeting as well. But field played a critical role in our work, and the campaign invested heavily in it. And by investing, I mean both financially, but also it just had huge support from everyone involved. Everyone understood that knocking doors and making phone calls and texting, directly speaking to voters, was going to be the absolute key to this thing.
Yeah. Yeah. That was something that we decided early on, that doing doors was going to be a crucial piece to this. We spent a lot of time, probably before you even got hired, spent a lot of time talking about that.
The buy-in was there when I arrived. It was already bought. The buy-in was already there.
And it was the methods of which we were going to do it, or how we were going to do it, that I think was sort of a challenge. And it's not something that everybody was bought into at the time. Like, it felt, it was new to some folks, right? And so I know some campaigns in the past have implemented a heavy, like, doors, or your what's your phrase, direct voter contact. You know, and so we wanted to do that throughout the state. It was probably, you know, through polling, you know, it informed us that that may not have been the most necessary thing to do throughout the state, but in certain places it was like strategically like really important that we can get some wins on this. And so we spent a lot of time like planning and figuring out how we're going to get there, how, what's it going to look like. I think, you know, Power Coalition did a great job of sort of, I think, educating a lot of people who were like on the more old school, like signs and things like that, and radio and TV ads. They did a great job of just like getting folks on board, and like they tailored their trainings on like with people who had limited sort of access to technology, or, you know, people who, you know, weren't really, you know, didn't really have a smartphone, right? And so, you know, really eliminating those barriers of entry.
Right, because we didn't use paper lists. We used those handheld devices for all
this. We were fortunate enough to raise a lot of money to where we were able to invest in phones and tablets that I think really helped us out a lot. And yeah, we were paperless. You know, it was something like even I was like uncomfortable with. I was like, you know, I would have people call me like every day, like, oh, I want to come like volunteer, you know, and, you know, it was like, okay, yeah, like we'd love to have you sign up. And it was like, but like, I just want to do this one day, or I just want to do like, when you guys go to Mid City, or when you guys go uptown, I want to do that one. And it's like, well, that's not like, oh, that's not necessarily how it works. And like, you know, my staff would probably like yell at me if I just let you like come in and, you know, I got to print like paper stuff for you, and like that's sort of more trouble than it's worth. You know, but yeah, no, it was definitely like, I think it was for folks who had worked on campaigns in the past, like some had not done paperless before.
So. And I'm glad you mentioned that training piece, because that's another element that I wasn't even thinking of that was so critical to making sure that we had people doing effective field work, that Power Coalition really did invest in training people.
Yeah. Power Coalition and Vote did training.
You're right.
Like before they were Power Coalition / Vote trainings. They weren't like yes on two trainings, right? They were just like trainings for their coalition members. And I think I was the only one on staff at the time. And then they were doing trainings throughout that summer. And so as we started getting staff and people who were interested, like I was like sending them to those trainings. And then when we did our own trainings, we basically used those training methods to get folks onboarded.
Well, and the other piece of the puzzle for me, because there are so many pieces of the puzzle, this is what I think is so great about the Unanimous Jury campaign, was it was such a full campaign. Like, it covered every kind of thing you could throw at a campaign. It did it. It did all the things. So one of the other pieces of the puzzle was that were these other groups who were not coming to knock doors from our office, but who were like Women with a Vision, had their own office. So they took their own groups of people and did their own targets, and the folks that they normally speak to in their parts of the city, they went and spoke to them. Jeremiah Group was holding phone banks and doing their faith-based work through their phone banks. Citizen She was up in Shreveport running the field efforts up there and doing both phone banking and door knocking. So there were all these other groups that were involved and took their own piece of the pie, you know, with them, so that they could handle it without, you know, we were checking in on them and we were talking to them and trying to make sure. And that's just, look, that's just a handful of folks. There were 20, 30 of those kind of groups that were doing things across the state.
Yeah.
And so we check in with them and make sure everybody was on the same page and make sure we weren't duplicating efforts or whatever, but, or having things fall through the cracks. But it took all those various groups stepping up and saying, I'll take my piece of the puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we raised a lot of money, there's always, every campaign has limited resources. So you're always thinking, you know, where can we best invest? And that was all a part of what this was trying to figure out where we needed to put the money most and where we could use people that were already on the ground doing work in different places.
Yeah, we did a lot of organizing around that. I think Norris called it. We were in like this like financial meeting. We had a, like different committees, like a finance committee, a communications committee. We were in a finance committee meeting. Norris, like, this is in July. Norris was like, you know, like it wasn't even an argument. We're just talking about like how we're going to some of these like national organizations and how we're going to ask. And Norris was like, well, you know, I don't need your money in October. I need your money now. Right. Like that should be the message. And he's like, I know what they're going to do. He's like, they're going to come to us in October after we get this thing rolling. And they're going to want to give us these like blank checks, and you know, all the work that we needed to do needs to get started now.
Right.
So, and it happened. That happened. Like we hit our funding goals early, but there was like an influx of money late. That wasn't like, it wasn't small, but it wasn't like, you know, $300,000, but it was like, it was enough money that we had to like account for it, and we had to figure out like, what are we going to do with this, right?
Right.
And so it was an opportunity to like look at, you know, there was never enough phone banking, there was never enough like, you know, outreach that we could have done, and so there were certain groups like the Jeremiah Project or Jeremiah Group or you know, Women with a Vision, who were already doing some of that type of work that we could like, you know, work with and let them just like take the ball and roll with it. You know, I think everybody sort of knew, you know, how we were, everybody had the same message, right? And I was less worried about message discipline with a group like Women with a Vision, who had done more door knocking than
they knew who they were speaking to. They had their own crew,
right?
Yeah. Well, and I'm glad you made that point too about the early money, because folks who don't work on campaigns don't understand the difference and how important that early money is. And I'd just like to remind folks from time to time that Emily's list, actually, Emily is not a person. It's an acronym for Early Money is Like Yeast. And so that's the point. If you're going to donate to a campaign, I'm just going to let folks know that if you're going to donate, donate early.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, that was, we had a good timeline of how we were, you know, going to try and hire up and things. There was never a moment where it's like, oh, we got to pay Chris. Like, you know, I think we were pretty good that first month, and the second month we started. I mean, that was most of what I was working on was, I was trying to support the fundraising efforts and also just like organizing how we're going to do things based on like, if we hit our fundraising goals, if we don't hit our fundraising goals, what does this look like?
Well, I do want to ask you about the fundraising in a little bit, but I'll also mention before we leave this field area that we also had a lot of free investments from groups like the Public Defenders. You mentioned from various cities across the state, Public Defenders would get together and make phone calls to voters. Yeah. We had folks from the Divine Nine. We had fraternity and sorority groups that were donating time to the efforts. And that's, again, just a couple of folks I'm naming. There's many more that did likewise. So that effort was so robust. It was incredible, the amount of voters we got to. And I'll make the point that part of how I knew it was so successful, we did earned media, we did social media, digital media, paid media, we had radio. Did we have TV? I don't remember if we went up on TV at all. No, but I know we had second lines, we had happy hours, we had events, we invited people to stuff. We were everywhere. And we engaged in every kind of constituency outreach I could imagine.
We had the Saints.
Oh, yeah. You had like DeVario Davis and Cam Jordan and folks like that, like on their Instagrams talking about it and stuff. By election day, when we were out in the streets reminding people to vote, there were random people who could recite our talking points back. Like, they knew the campaign so well. They'd heard it so much from so many angles and so many people that if I started to go into our spiel about Constitutional Amendment 2, they could tell me before I told them. It was so well known. It was really incredible.
Yeah, that was really incredible, like how all hands on deck it got. I remember the pinnacle for me was the rap video directed by B Mike that like I didn't even know it was like happening. Yeah. They asked for some signs. Some folks asked for some signs, and like, you know, I gave them like a stack, and then like next thing I know, it was like, oh, it's for a rap video. But yeah, that was truly special.
And where did that play? Just online?
It was just online. It was on YouTube.
Gotcha. Okay.
You should look it up if you haven't seen it. It was great.
I may have seen it back then and I don't remember it. So I will definitely look it up. I'll put a link to it in the episode notes for folks who want to see it. Our political outreach, I think we started struggling with for a little bit, particularly with the Legislative Black Caucus, who really pulled the bill through, right? Mm-hmm. Legislature.
I don't want to play devil's act. Was it a struggle? I think that it was a calculated effort to do things the way that we did them.
Okay.
I think that politicians and we didn't there are a lot of members of the Black Caucus, right? Who had obviously by virtue of being elected officials had run some form of a campaign. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We were with JP Morrell early. Mm-hmm. Well, he was probably the first one that we worked with or that we like, you know, took meetings with.
He carried the bill and we covered that on a previous Lefty episode at great length.
Yeah. But I think that it was really important that we did this for us with our people.
Okay.
Right? Like that we controlled this campaign. We controlled sort of the narrative. We controlled like how this was going to go, and not something where like we give this to a bunch of like lobbyists and the politicians that they work with, right? That's not a shot at them.
Right.
It's just like it was more important for us to get folks like a Jennifer Harding or Kelly Garrett involved, who had been involved in the legislative outreach, who had done, you know, some work with Emerge. Like it was more important for us to get them involved in this, and given, and even though they don't have, they didn't have all the experience, we had the support for them, right? That was like a calculated effort that we made very early on, which I think probably didn't sit well. We probably could have reached out to the politicians earlier, but like my guess, and I'm not outing anyone, but like they had their thoughts on who should be running the campaign, right? After we took the meeting, when we had the big Black caucus meeting with them, like there were people who reached out to me on the side and had very strong, like they felt like we dropped the ball on the whole entire campaign. So we've talked, you and I have talked for the last like, you know, 45 minutes or so on some of the great things that we did. Those things don't happen if we get a lot of the politicians involved, right? And I think like that's, we just, I don't know if we could have done all the things that we were able to do if we had more chefs in the kitchen.
That makes sense.
But it got us, you know, it had some folks felt some type of way about it. And it took a lot of work to like sort of rally them. I think, you know, looking back, we probably could have involved them a little bit earlier than we did. Some folks were more angry and upset than others. But I do think that it was important that like we established ourselves, like our people, we hired our folks before like we reached out to politicians who may have wanted their people in a lot of the positions that we hire.
A valid point. And I'll also make the point that the whole time frame for this thing was still pretty fast. What'd you say? You came on July 1st for...
We had our first meeting in mid to late June. So like the session had just like ended. We had inside baseball, we had our first meeting like early June.
Okay.
I would say late May. But it was like the session was pretty much like it just happened, right?
This is all happening in about 5 months time though. The whole
thing
happening in about 5 months time. And then what I'll say is that we did end up, the Black Caucus became great partners for Get Out the Vote, where they took over their districts as the folks who were going to do whatever visibility events they chose to do, whether that was sign waving or whether they did radio ads in their district or robocalls or whatever. They all came up with their own plan for how they wanted to turn out their voters. And what that allowed us to do by incorporating them into the Get Out the Vote efforts was cover all these districts across the state where we didn't previously have any reach.
Yeah.
And where we didn't have legislative Black caucus members, we had folks in the NAACP step up and some churches
faith,
as well
yeah,
step up and yeah,
community organizing
and say, we'll take on those efforts that the Black caucus were doing. We had those folks taking care of stuff there. So again, just indicative and illustrative of the immense efforts that were all these folks that kind of pitched in to help pull this thing over the finish line. None of this was possible without massive amounts of donations. And you were talking about that a little while ago. I was not involved in any of the fundraising. I've done a couple of episodes with finance directors for campaigns because I think that's where we struggle a lot in this state is getting the money to do stuff. But I am interested in your take on the fundraising piece of this.
Our largest donors were relationships that had already been had through like each of, like, it was because we had a great coalition, right? And the work that we had, like, reached beyond the state of Louisiana through folks like ACLU, Southern Poverty Law Center were sort of our two big ones. But, like, you know, Kima Robinson from Converge for Change was a massive help. Flo Zell Daniels from FFL helped us out a lot. But, like, the main two were Ben Cohen and Norris Henderson. Like, I think they really carried the water on a lot of our fundraising efforts. You know, Andrea Armstrong also was, like, was also incredible. Did a lot of relationship building for us. And so, like, that was one where people just, like, leaned on their prior relationships. And, you know, SPLC was a very early adopter. They were very early on, you know, getting us money from their campaign fund. And ACLU gave us a lot of C3 dollars that really helped sort of set up the coalition part so that we can start raising money more for the ballot committee, which was really where, you know, that's when you came along.
I have to say, you're repeating what I've heard other folks in the finance space say, which is it's all about relationships. It's all about the relationships you develop before you go to ask for the money. And it's about maintaining those relationships through the campaign, beyond the campaign, for what you plan to do next. I think that's the key element that our folks here really need to be working on.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that criminal justice reform lends itself to, I think we're just more mature in the amount of time that we've been doing this work and I think we've just had more organizations and organizing done in this particular field that has reached to like foundations that, you know, are willing to give large dollar donations to, like, whatever project that folks like Norris are working on. And so, I think it's coming for reproductive justice. I think that kind of money is probably coming for a lot of, like, the environmental work that's happening around the state. The LGBTQ rights money is probably coming through as well. It's just, like, a lot of those organizations just haven't had the national, like, news kind of cycle. They haven't been in the national news cycle the way, like, you know, like some of the work that, like, IPNO does, right? Where somebody's like,
IPNO being the Innocence Project.
So it's just like, it's just a different landscape in each one of those issues. But I think, like, those organizations are I think probably going to be able to, those issues are going to be able to raise money, I think, because those are just more hot button issues right now.
And those relationships are probably being built now so that,
for sure,
down the road,
absolutely,
that money will be more accessible. Are there any elements to the unanimous jury campaign that I haven't asked you about that I'm missing?
No, I mean, like, we did the political, the financial, the comms, the events, like, we covered pretty much all of them. I think the field was, I have taken a lot, I've done some other campaign work in the last couple of years, and, I use your phrase of just, like, direct voter contact, Linda Woolard will tell you the first thing is direct voter contact. Usually some curse words behind it just for emphasis, like, you're not knocking doors, like, what are you doing, right. But no, I think that was the main piece.
Okay. Do you see other campaigns having learned the lessons of Yes On Two? Have you been seeing anyone replicating these yet?
Elements of it. I mean, we were a ballot initiative, so some of the things that we were able to get away with,
sure,
we're, you know, like there's certain ethical things that we can do as a ballot initiative or as a ballot that we were able to set up as a ballot committee. You know, we were able to do that, like a candidate can't necessarily do. And so, but like, there's definitely like, I know, in the race right now, like Mandy Landry is using, you know, a lot of the same direct voter contact work. I think Royce is doing that as well. You know, I know Troy Carter did it. You know, the congressional race, what was that, 2021? Like, I think every candidate used sort of the vote builder or used the van, you know, and so, which is not, you know, the app and not necessarily the paper stuff.
Right.
And so I think like that wasn't a yes on two thing, but I think that we definitely had a hand in like sort of modernizing, bringing people on board to those things. You know, it's always great to see people that we worked with on the campaign doing other campaigns and utilizing sort of some of that work. And, you know, and I personally have like the work that I've done, whether it was for the DA's race or the sheriff's race last year, like, you know, a lot of people only brought me in because they were like, oh, like, you know, we saw what you did last year. Like, we'd love to see, get your opinion on how we do these things. My favorite line was I was in a meeting with someone with a group, and somebody like said, like, you know, I think it was the public defender group. This was when we were getting starting to organize the public defenders. Somebody said, like, yeah, like I thought the Yes on Two campaign had like a really good campaign. I'd love to like sort of follow that. And I'm just like laughing. I'm just like, oh yeah.
Yeah, I can tell you about that.
And like, yeah, I can give you some pointers on them. I know a few contacts, you know.
Well, and look, I'll say we didn't have the same amount of money or the use all the elements of Yes on Two. And in particular, I'm thinking we didn't really do any constituency outreach or whatever, but the PAC for Justice work we did in support of Susan Hudson, I mimicked as much of unanimous juries as I could, really.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, you know, the PAC for Justice was, I mean, like, I don't know how many people are publicly part of PAC for Justice, but I know like three people within that group that like I worked with directly on Yes on Two. So it was like, you know.
So it's a little, it's like a mini offshoot of.
I mean, the spirit of it is in there, right?
That's right. Well, what has it been like for you since unanimous juries? You're still working in this criminal justice reform space, this movement space. So what's that been like for you working in an area that sort of directly impacted by that, but you're also still working for improvement and progress in that area?
Yeah. I mean, like I take meetings every year. And every year I say like, oh, I'm going to like, you know, I'm going to dial it back. I'm not going to get involved. And like every year is like, end up like in the last minute just like feeling some form of guilt for not doing more, and so I take on more than I intended. But yeah, like 2019 I worked with this guy Max Rose. I don't know if Max has been on your podcast yet.
He hasn't, and that's a good, by the way, I should absolutely have Max on.
Max had done some organizing in North Carolina around sheriff's elections. I guess that was the first time you and I like hung out after, you know, after I left. But like Max and I went to Baton Rouge to try and organize a little effort for the Baton Rouge sheriff's race, which did not go our way. But, you know, it was a good introduction for Max and a lot of like Louisiana folks that I thought was really, really helpful. And I think played a part in Max sort of helping out in the efforts of the New Orleans Sheriff's race last year. Mm-hmm. But I did that one, and then, you know, we did, you know, the flip the bench movement in 2020.
Right. And that's sort of a pack for justice.
That was sort of pack for justice, sort of main pack, I think, behind a lot of that. And
to be clear,
it was an IE.
I was not involved at the time in that. Just to be clear.
I mean, you know, Pack for Justice did a lot of great work. I think, you know, there being an independent expenditure was like sort of there was a space for more organizing without stepping on anyone's toes, which is what we did with the NOLA Defenders group. And there was other groups and that were involved in that. You know, we got two judges, we got the DA.
You've worked in the DA's office now, right?
I'm no longer there. But you have worked. Yeah, I was with the Civil Rights Division at the DA's office.
And what was that like being able to implement some of these things?
So like in the office, it was mostly like we were working with a lot of groups. Like, you know, we had to correspond a lot with the Public Defender's Office. We had to correspond a lot with Vote and with the First 72 Plus and the Parole Project. And so having a lot of those relationships that I've had for years and with folks definitely made the communication like a lot easier. You know, it was more direct service than policy making, which is a little different than, you know, sort of the roles that I held with the electoral politics. But the relationships that I've been able to build and maintain definitely made things like so much easier for us and really definitely helped us move the project and get things going. But Emily Maw and that team is so incredible, and they've been able to help get folks released on really wild charges. And so it you know, that was great work, and I really, you know, I think fondly of my time there.
You and some other folks have started a pack, NOLA Rising pack.
Yeah. Definitely.
What are your plans with that? And is that something folks can plug into if they're interested?
Yeah. So we're still, you know, we have, you know, that's a challenge. I mean, it's still out there. I think that, you know, I don't want to bury the lead on, I think there's some other stuff we're going to talk about, but like, you know, I think it was a great start. But I think it sort of plays into like, there's a finite amount of energy I think people have for like campaign work year mm-hmm. to year. And a lot of it isn't like somebody's like main job. And so when that's not your main job, these campaigns can just be brutal, even if you're just giving like a handful of hours to it. And so we took a little time this year. We're due for another meeting, but that like the idea was to create a space for young progressives who believe in more than just like whatever your issue is, like for me, like criminal justice reform. It might be for somebody else who might be doing more environmental work, you know, a way for folks to plug in and sort of get involved with these campaigns and that are happening. You know, unfortunately, all we've had is like sheriff and DA but like for me, I joined Pact for Justice and helped start it so that we could like expand it beyond just sheriff and DA and these like other roles, but like we can put sort of our values into like a city council member, right?
The NOLA Rising pack. You mean.
NOLA Rising, I'm sorry. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, like having a wider reach beyond just like these, you know, small roles. You know, I think that was sort of where NOLA Rising came from.
And is that something folks could sign up to join if they wanted, or?
We still have a sign up. We need to meet. I think there's more planning that needs to be done. I think 2022 has been sort of a break year for us, but I fully intend on keeping it going. And we started it NOLA Rising to do this long term.
Yeah. I think you've got some social media. I can.
NOLA Rising Pack has a social media handle that I can drop to you.
Yeah, I'll put it in the episode notes. So if anyone wants to follow you on social media and kind of keep up with how they might engage long term, they can do that. Is there any other work that you're doing that folks might be interested in plugging into, or?
Nothing yet. I think there's going to be some stuff coming up in 2023, some races that are going to be really interesting.
Well, that's the big state and regional and city races in Louisiana. Yeah. So, yeah.
So 2023 is going to be, I think, a really big year, obviously. And I am definitely excited and don't have anything right yet to.
That's okay. We don't have to break news on that. We'll wait for y'all to make your decisions next year. Well, Chris, thank you for talking to me about all this stuff. I want to pivot to the last three questions. I ask a version of every episode. What, in your opinion, is the biggest obstacle for progressives in Louisiana?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest obstacle for progressives right now is just keeping the energy. I don't think there's any like progressive movement, like organizing this year, which is sort of, I feel, probably one of the things I feel bad about with like NOLA Rising is just like, you know, it's people are just get burnt out, you know, and so I think our biggest obstacle is just like, recognizing that this isn't like a year to year thing. We got to do this every single year. And just answering the question, like, how do you like capture that every single year, even if there isn't like a race, like a DA or, you know, something that affects you?
How do you make it sustainable for long-term growth? Got you. What's the biggest opportunity?
It's that there are people who want a place to plug in. There's I think that there's so many people who have felt like sort of had this sort of malaise when it comes to like politics, especially like in areas outside of New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think capturing that like thirst for more, I think could be something if there is somebody who wants to take that on, like there's the opportunity to like capture more voters and capture the type of people who really want to like go sign like 50 people up, you know, to vote, right? People who are willing to do more outreach, more, you know, get out the vote efforts, but they're just like, they don't have, there isn't like 12 different organizations like in those areas. And it's great to see like Step Up go to a place like Jefferson Parish, right? I think that's huge because it's touching voters. It is getting to voters in a different way than just like yes on two. It's sort of like an all year round thing of keeping people informed. And I think, you know, I just don't think that we have any, I mean, Together Louisiana does some, but like the northern part of the state, the northeastern part of the state.
Yes.
I think there's huge opportunity for somebody to like take on that area and just be the central hub for like, not just progressive, but for like, you know, more left-leaning, you know, elections. Like, I think it's just somebody's got to do it.
Yeah, that's right. It's consistently a place that I struggle to find someone to go to there. But I'm thrilled that you've taken on the idea of NOLA Rising. I love the folks that you've started it with. And I think there is a lot of hope there. And hopefully there will be other people who can connect to that. And if not be a part of NOLA Rising, maybe create similar structures in their own area so that y'all can coordinate together, but still be doing your own things in your own regions.
Yeah, definitely. I'm excited about 2023. I think, you know, there's going to be a lot of work to do. So, and I think there's going to be a lot of, you know, people we get, I backed off on folks, like, you know, I'm not, you know, trying to convert anyone this year, but next year it's going to be like, going to be hitting them a lot harder.
Look out. All right, Chris, who's your favorite superhero?
Gosh. I actually thought about this and stressed me out. I love like Batman has always been my guy, but like, I don't think he's a superhero, right? Like,
okay.
That
counts as a superhero, but you can say,
I don't know. What does he do? He's just rich, you know? He's rich and athletic, you know? I don't think he, you know, he's a great detective, you know? But it's not like a superpower, you know.
Okay.
Let's go with I'll go with Superman. Just be very basic.
Right on. All right. You may be the first Superman that I've gotten. Then
it's honestly stressed me out thinking of this. You know, I was like, man, like
I always tell people there are no rules to favorite superhero. You know, sure. People say mom or dad or.
Oh my gosh! I can't. Yeah, that's.
That's I'm not saying awesome. You should. I'm just saying people have given every number, all kinds of answers. That
sure, sure. Somebody's got to do Superman, you know.
And I've told people this in interviews, but I've never said on the podcast. I'm wearing a Loki shirt. I like, you know, a good villain as well as like a good superhero. But what I love about Loki is the Loki arc that.
You like somebody's like full like story, you know,
the story where he becomes a superhero.
There
right?
you go.
I love that. That's right on target. Anyway, Chris, I love getting to see you and talk to you. Thank you so much. I'm so excited we finally got to do this.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Louisiana Lefty. Please follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Thank you to Ben Collinsworth for producing Louisiana Lefty. Jen Pack of Black Cat Studios for our Super Lefty artwork, and $1,000 Car for allowing us to use their Swamp Pop Classic Security Guard as our Louisiana Lefty theme song.